I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. Welcome to Radio Times. 5 years ago, our guest Cinzi Clemons was getting her MFA and working on a novel when her mother was diagnosed with breast cancer. She left school to take care of her mother, who lived in Philadelphia. She stopped writing her original novel and began jotting down notes and vignettes and bits and pieces of text as she dealt with the overwhelming sadness of losing one of her parents. That novel, What We Lose, has just been published and is about a young woman named Tandi, who, like Cinzi Clemons, is the child of a South African mother and an African-American father who goes to Philadelphia to care for her dying mother. Tandi calls herself a strange in-betweener, neither fully accepted by any race because of her light skin and foreign roots. The novel has gotten rave reviews for its moving and innovative exploration of grief, identity, love, race, and sex. Cinzi Clemons joins us here on Radio Time. She's co-founder of Apogee Journal, a contributing editor to Literary Hub. And Cinzi Clemons, nice to have you with us on Radio Times, and congratulations on your novel. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Thank you so much, and it's just such an honor to be here, as I've listened to the show for many years, and it's sort of surreal.
To be sitting across from each other.
Yeah.
Well, welcome, and I'd love to have you begin with a reading from the very beginning of the book.
Sure. I was born as apartheid was dying. In South Africa, fervent national pride and multiculturalism were taking hold as the new national policy. I was born in America. My mother was born in Johannesburg, and my father in New York. My mother's entire family still lives within 20 minutes of each other. They are middle to upper-class coloreds, mixed race, not black. Although my mom involved herself in some of the political unrest, she proudly saved a newspaper clipping from 1970 that has a photograph prominently featuring a handwritten sign she made. My family was quiet and generally avoided the brunt of the conflict. My father was raised in New York and went to college in Philadelphia. In the year after his graduation, he went on a trip volunteering in Botswana. My mother was there, partying with some of her militant friends. Ostensibly, they were there collecting literature to distribute back home. "Your mother was inescapable," my father told me. Not that she was ravishing or enchanting, but that he simply couldn't get away from her. When I went back to Philadelphia, she called me, and she called me again. When I called her back, she asked if I could come to America to live with me. My mother befriended people aggressively. She was extremely opinionated and often abrasive. I sometimes hated the rough manner in which she dealt with people. Her favorite words were four-lettered, and she liked to yell at waiters in restaurants and people in line at stores. My mother's roots were deep and strong. Her relationships with others were resilient. She had friendships that persisted over decades, oceans, breakups. Her best friends were all former boyfriends. Most of her friends, and she had many, spoke of her offending them shortly after they met. One story my mother told often was when one of her best friends threatened to commit suicide after her boyfriend left her. She went to my mother for comfort, and my mother slapped her across the face as hard as she could. Her friend's face was bruised for a week. My mother used this story as an illustration of how to be a good friend.
And that's Cinzi Clemons reading from the very beginning of her new book, What We Lose, and what a way to start. I was thinking, what a great mother for a novelist to write about, but what a difficult mother for a daughter. And I guess it's probably unfair, but nonetheless, how much was your mother like Tandi's mother?
Well, first of all, you know, it is a novel,
yes.
So there are parts that are not true, and those are mostly small details. But on the whole, I often like to say that my mother was a great gift because she was a character in herself, and I did not have to do very much inventing. So I think if you read the book, you get a very good idea of who my mother was as a person.
And what it was like to be her daughter, right?
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Yeah.
You did come back when your mother was diagnosed with breast cancer. You did come back to Philadelphia to take care of her. Did you feel you had what she needed at that time in her life?
Did I feel like I had what she needed.
Yes. I mean, did she want you there, or did you feel like you needed to be there?
Yeah. First of all, just one small thing. My mom actually didn't have breast cancer. She had another form of cancer.
You know what? Take the headphones off because they're cutting in and out. So they're obviously making it difficult to talk. No, go ahead. Go ahead.
First of all, my mom actually didn't have breast cancer. I think that maybe comes from the epigraph of the book where I quote a breast cancer statistic, but it's a small detail.
Right.
It was an incredibly important thing for me to come back home, and I think it's interesting that you sort of phrased the question that way. I did not realize at the time that that was what I needed to do. At the time, I thought that I had to do it. And over many years, even after she passed away, a lot of it through therapy and, you know, the intervention of friends, I did realize that it was a choice that I made, and I realized why I made that choice.
For her and for you, probably.
Yeah. You know, this relationship that we had was always very fraught, as you kind of see in the book. And I did need to go to sort of resolve things. And that is exactly what happened when I went back home.
In fact, the title of this book, What We Lose, comes from a pamphlet. This was a hospice pamphlet. That was the title of it. And hospice, obviously, helping family members and the dying person dealing mm-hmm. with what they are going through. Were you given a pamphlet called What We Lose?
I was given a pamphlet. I also found many pamphlets. I'm really a researcher. I did a lot of research for this book, and I came across very similar literature. So what you see in the book is probably best described as a composite, and mm-hmm. I fictionalized it, but it gives the sort of flavor of a lot of this literature and the sort of distanced, sort of scientific language that is supplied to people who are going through this very emotional experience.
Was that helpful, though? Sometimes to be able to label things and define things?
Yeah, I think kind of what you see throughout the book is the narrator's attempt to make sense of what's going on in her life. And to make sense of this loss through gathering a ton of material. And I think it's through the process of gathering and synthesizing that she's able to move on. And that's something similar to what I went through in my life.
In fact, as I read about what you did when you went home to take care of your mother, was writing in these bits and pieces, probably Tondi sits in the kitchen, that was her world. I don't know if that was true for you, mm-hmm. But that's how you have to write when someone really needs someone so much.
Yeah, absolutely. So what happened was at the time I was actually working on another novel that was more linear and traditional. And at the same time, I was going through this, and so I would have very exhausting days. And at the end, I would only have the energy to kind of scroll down a paragraph or a sentence, or sometimes, you know, I would be collecting quotes from books, and I kind of amassed them in this folder on my computer, which is how I journal.
Sure.
And at some point, I revisited them, and I realized that there was something there, and that's how this book came about.
A collage?
Yes.
In fact, I even read a description where once you had all these bits and pieces together, that you laid them out on the floor. Did I get that right or wrong?
Absolutely right, and I love that anecdote. It actually comes from an interview I did with my former journal. I actually laid them out on several different floors, so I had about a year that was spent in the revision process where I was traveling around to different residencies, artist residencies, and just partaking in this process of ordering the book in different ways and experimenting with it.
So your visual writer? Your visual writer?
Very much so, yes. I think that comes from, I have a background in visual art, and I've always done graphic design and worked on publications. So it's kind of just a natural part of my point of view and my point of view as an artist.
Tanya talks about herself as a strange in-betweener. Do you sometimes feel like a strange in-betweener?
Yes, very much so. I think that phrase perhaps unintentionally describes a lot of who I am.
Is that a bad place to be, a strange in-betweener?
Interesting question. I think it's uncomfortable mm-hmm. at times. You know, it's lonely at times, but ultimately I think it's a very good thing and sort of a good thing to grow used to and deal with. You know, I said in an interview once that that's sort of how I grew up. And when I learned to deal with that, it became a real gift in my later life.
How did you learn to deal with it? Not easy.
No.
Not easy to feel no. sort of that you don't exactly belong
yeah.
any place.
Yeah, you know, there are two writers that I really looked to for this experience. One is Zadie Smith, who wrote a really wonderful essay called Speaking in Tongues that's about being mixed race. And I think when I read that essay, it was probably the first time that I felt less lonely in that experience. The second one is in the book, our former president, Barack Obama. And for both of them, I think they gave me a real positive take on being a mixed person. Before that, I never really identified as mixed. And what they both said is that, you know, there's a real gift to being in an in-between place mm-hmm. because you have a sort of fluency with all different kinds of cultures. And it was a process, and I think I read those writers later in the process, and it kind of sealed something for me, and it made me more proactive and to feel powerful in that identity.
We're almost up on a break here, but did it also help you be a writer, to be an in-betweener?
Absolutely, yeah. You know, a writer is someone who by nature is not a participant. A writer is someone who sits back and observes and hopefully, you know, helps temper some of the action that goes on around them. You know, we're now witnessing the result of a lot of impulsive behavior. And I think however you arrive at that in-betweener or outsider identity is what makes you a writer.
And that is Zinzi Clemens, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. She is a writer. She's got a new novel. It's her debut novel, and it's called What We Lose. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. We'll get another reading as well. And the lines are open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. Much more to talk about after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, and I'm talking with Zinzi Clemens. Her debut novel, What We Lose, includes photographs and graphs and one-sentence pages and short vignettes and lists and drawings, all telling the story of a young woman named Tondi dealing with her grief over her mother's death. And like Tondi, Clemens' mother was South African. Her father is African American. She grew up in and around Philadelphia. I'd love to have you do another reading from your book, and this, of course, is Tondi speaking.
I've often thought that being a light-skinned black woman is like being a well-dressed person who is also homeless. You may be able to pass in mainstream society, appearing acceptable to others, even desired. But in reality, you have nowhere to rest, nowhere to feel safe. Even while you're out in public, feeling fine and free, inside, you cannot shake the feeling of rootlessness. Others may even envy you. But this masks the fact that at night, there is nowhere safe for you, no place to call your own.
I mean, that's the kind of in-betweener feeling or experience that you were talking about before.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Related to skin color.
Yeah. And it's a It is, and it's also related to, various other forms of identity, too. I think whenever you're part already of a marginalized group and then have another identity inside of that, all of these sort of situations and conflicts arise. And I often, I'm an idealist, and I'm also somebody who tries to write into existence a world that I want to see. Mm-hmm. And solidarity sometimes eludes us.
At one point in this story, she's the only black girl at a party, and a white girl says to her, "You're not like a real black person." But Tani's mother also says, "You're never going to have a true friendship with a dark-skinned person." Mm-hmm. These are two really, to my mind, outrageous, controversial, fascinating, off-putting things to have said. Mm-hmm. How do you wrestle with that?
Well, I think it's very important because those are things that people have really latched on to. And, I've had people come up to me and make comments about them, both people I know and people I don't. And I think it's, first of all, very important to notice that I don't try and resolve any of these things in the book. I just kind of let them be.
Right.
For me, those things were part of wanting to acknowledge some of the ugliness that I've seen around me, and this is a lot of my experience growing up in South Africa was particularly, even more so because racism is much more overt there, was just hearing outrageous things all the time. And to me, the most tragic part about it was that they were allowed to be kept secrets. And so for me, we've had this phrase come into prominence, sunlight is the best disinfectant.
Right.
And we can argue whether that's true or not, but I felt like it was important to at least acknowledge that they happen.
And to say it.
And to say it, yeah.
Without resolving it.
Yeah. I also think that every text is sort of part of a conversation, and I don't have to give an answer. Sometimes I can just pose a question.
There's a lot of sex in this book, and I commend you on, I think, writing in a really real and sexy way about sex. I'll just put it that way. But one of the things that Tandi says, and it's so interesting to me because we think of sex and death, but she says, after her mother died, my sex drive was merciless. You're grinning.
Yeah, I'm just thinking, sorry, Dad.
Well, I'm sure he's read the book, so,
yes,
the cat is out of the bag, so to speak.
Yeah.
Do you see the connection, though, between sex and death? I mean, I was thinking about that, which is, of course, about touch and about release.
Yeah.
About feeling sort of unmoored, mm-hmm. alone even.
Yeah, exactly. When you're going through that, you really do hunger for intimacy more than anything and to feel alive. The other part of it is that when you're going through grief, even very deep grief, your life keeps going. And I think that is really one of the most bewildering things about loss. And one of the saddest is that you're not able to just stop the world. It right. keeps coming at you. And you just have to kind of deal with it.
One chapter, Tani really falls in love. It feels very real to her with Peter. And then the next chapter is about serial killers' wives, and I guess why they fall in love with serial killers. Is there something you're trying to say there by putting those two chapters next to each other?
Yeah, this was one of those parts of the book that I had a lot of people question, but I was attached to it.
But you're telling us something here.
I am telling. Yes. I am saying something. What I'm saying is at this time in her life particularly, falling in love feels very scary.
You don't know this person, right?
Yeah, and love in general is scary, but when you're that vulnerable, it's terrifying. And, that situation could happen. You don't know. And being in love means being completely at the mercy of someone else. And, yeah.
Let me get Alice from Pennsylvania to join our conversation. Alice, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
Zinzi, I remember you from when you were 3 years old at Lansdowne Friends School.
Oh, my goodness.
I'm Teacher Alice.
Hello.
I heard your name when I was driving to school to work today. So, very excited to hear you on the radio.
Thank you.
And I think it's very funny because one thing I remember was that we had an old typewriter, manual typewriter in the classroom, and you were 3 years old and you were typing. You had typed Z. Z-I-I-N. I said, okay, you need another Z, and you said, I have one.
Oh, that's
need
great.
Another I. I have one.
That's a great story, Alice.
Thank you so much.
I also remember the day that Mandela was released, and you and your mother came to school, and your mother was like, oh, my God, we've been up all night. We've been on the radio. We've been up on the phone. It's just all chaos at our house.
That's great, Alice. I appreciate the call to Radio
Times.
Thank
you so much.
Thank
you so much.
That's what happens when you interview someone that grew up in the radio station region that we are broadcasting from. And that's Zinzi Clemens. We're talking about her new novel. In fact, it's her debut novel. It's called What We Lose. And again, you can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. As I said, this book is about so many different things, including grief. And clearly, it seems you were writing this or you wrote this to deal with the grief of over the loss of your mother. And you include in this book this, and I know this photograph, and I'm sure listeners will as well, by Kevin Carter. It's really a starving child in Sudan. It's a black and white photograph. You include this in this story. And in the photo, you see this vulture that's just almost like waiting for this child to die. What does that photo mean to you?
What page is it on?
22.
I want to look at it.
Yeah, 22. 23. It's a heartbreaking, just the most heartbreaking, because the child is all alone.
Yeah, so the child is starving, and you can kind of see their ribs. And it means a lot of things. And importantly, I think, you have to read it in context with his biography.
The photographer's biography.
Yes. Because he was a conflict photographer and photographed the bloodiest conflicts during apartheid. And basically, the narrative that is taken from his life is that he could not deal with the heavy burden of what he was seeing and the responsibility of his job. And I think part of it is, you know, an acknowledgement of my responsibility as an artist, but also the responsibility of anyone who bears witness to death and loss.
Suffering,
yeah. And that can mean someone like me who is doing it in a public way, but also our responsibility to each other, particularly when it comes to race and across races and to other people who we count as part of our so-called tribe.
Because the sad part, I mean, there are many sad parts of his story, Kevin Carter, but he killed himself.
Yeah.
Maybe just having witnessed just so much pain and loss and suffering.
Yeah, and he was somebody who constantly wrestled with the fact that he was white. And he was witnessing people who looked like him who were committing such atrocities against black people. And I think he also was someone who struggled to place himself within that because he didn't identify with the oppressor. And I would never say that he did, but there were attempts to make him, to make him that. And I guess, this is also part of the in-betweener and the observer, that very heavy, heavy burden and loneliness again.
We heard from your kindergarten teacher about you in the
typewriter. So amazing. I'm still recovering. Thank you so much, Keith.
So did you want to be a writer when you were a little girl growing up?
Actually, when she called in, I was just thinking, I never did, but over the process of publishing this novel, I've had teachers come up to me and say, I remember when you were writing back then. I thought I was going to be a doctor.
Right. Did you want to be a doctor?
I thought that I did, but at this point I question that. I think I thought that it was something that I should do and something that I could do and be interested in. But at the same time that I was doing that, I was also doing a lot of visual art, as I mentioned. And I always kind of hungered for self-expression. And I think probably part of what Teacher Alice was getting at is that I've always been a very assertive person. I've always wanted to express my opinion. One thing that I've always remembered is I had a teacher in like third grade who said I would be a Supreme Court justice.
Wow. There's still time.
Yeah. And I, you know, as I said, I just always wanted my point of view out in the world, and I've always been very strong and unapologetic about that.
And your parents were immigrants, and sometimes immigrant parents, you know, want their children to be, or your mother was, a doctor, a lawyer, a professional person. Did you feel that as well?
Absolutely. So my mom was an immigrant herself, but my dad's family came over from Trinidad, and they grew up. He grew up in a heavily immigrant neighborhood, and you know, they kind of boosted themselves out of a completely different background. And I'm very proud of everything that they've done. There was always definitely that pressure to earn. And that's actually part of why I founded the journal Apogee that I did, and why I've always worked in editorial places, because I recognize that writers of color and people who come from different places that are not part of the mainstream do need that extra boost to get there. So it's something I've always been very conscious of and tried to kind of correct in my career.
So did you say to your parents, I'm going to be a writer? I'm not going to be a doctor. I'm going to be a writer.
It took a while. Yeah. First, I told them I wasn't going to be a doctor, and I started studying. I did media studies and philosophy, and then I was also writing, and a few years later, I told them that I wanted to be a writer.
What did they say?
Oh, I don't think they had any point of reference for it. But I think it was probably very bewildering. One thing that I did was that I never said that until I had some kind of proof in hand. So that's sort of what has always kept me going. I have to give them credit for that. I never said I wanted to be a writer until I had some proof that I could be.
So you had written?
Till I had gotten some kind of affirmation from the outside that I was good and I could do it, you know.
Well, I'd love to have you read another section from your novel on page 121.
My mother is dead, but I still see her, but I still feel her. I can still hear her voice, even right now as I am speaking to you. But she is dead. When I look at this picture of her at the beach, I can feel the sun on my skin. I can hear the way she spoke to me. But she is gone. I can dream her, and I can hear her cry. She tells me what happened that day, and she cries with me. She tells me not to be afraid. But she is dead. A part of her is still alive in me. But she is gone. She will live forever in heaven, but she is not on earth. Parts of her will live on in the trees and the streams and the birds of tomorrow. She is the water and the plants and the bits of dust I see swirl in columns of light. But she is dead. If I look long enough at a flower, I can see the color of her cheeks in the stigma. But she is not here.
I really love that passage, and I wonder if that was hard for you to write, and even that declarative sentence, but she is dead. I mean, we often use euphemisms for death. I don't necessarily like that, but I
mean, it was hard for me to read just now.
It's very powerful.
You know, actually, this felt like catharsis when I started writing these passages. And what I'm really playing with here is the kind of disconnect between, you know, when loss is still very fresh. Unfortunately, in my family, we just lost another cousin at a very young age. And
I'm sorry to hear that.
I received a text from a cousin. This is in South Africa. And she said, I just keep having to tell myself over and over that he's dead.
Mm.
And I think this feels very true to that experience, is when it's still fresh, the person is still there with you, and you have to keep convincing yourself that this is reality, and that's what this is about.
Did this book help you? I mean, help you as a daughter?
Yes, very much. You know, it really helped me to, number one, to do what I've done on this page, to absorb what was going on, but also it really helped me through writing about my mother to understand things from her perspective. It was a very long process of me accepting that our relationship was over and being okay with where it was. You know, that's the difficult part about losing a parent young. And, you know, for people for whom it happens even more unexpectedly, it's even harder. You have to accept that your relationship is what it was and live with whatever went on.
Yeah.
And I did that a lot through the process of writing this book.
Are you working on another book?
Yes. So my publisher purchased 2 books for me when they signed this book on, and I'm pretty sure that the next one will be a collection of my essays, which I've written quite a few of. So,
well, it's been a great pleasure. Zinzi Clemens, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. And again, her new book, her debut novel, What We Lose, has just been published. She grew up here in the Philadelphia area, co-founder of Apogee Journal, a contributing editor to Literary Hub. We're going to take a very short break, and then we'll be talking with Carol Lennig from The Washington Post. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Yesterday, President Trump signed legislation imposing sanctions on Russia, Iran, and North Korea that was passed overwhelmingly by Congress while complaining that it included provisions that were clearly unconstitutional. His words, unlike other signings, this one was done out of the public eye. The allegations of campaign collusion with Russia continue to dog the president and his family. The Washington Post reported that the president had personally dictated the misleading statement that his son had met with Russians in June 2016 to discuss the adoption of Russian children. This Post story contradicted what Trump's lawyer, Jay Sekulow, told ABC's Good Morning on July 12th.
The president didn't sign off on anything. He was coming back from the G20. The statement that was released on Saturday was released by Donald Trump Jr., and I'm sure in consultation with his lawyers. The president wasn't involved in that.
This week, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, the White House press secretary, responded to the Post story this way in this edited clip.
The president weighed in as any father would based on the limited information that he had. He certainly didn't dictate, but, you know, he, like I said, he weighed in, offered suggestion like any father would do.
Washington Post reporter Carol Lennig joined us, part of the reporting team that broke the story about President Trump. And Carol, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Glad to be here, Marty.
So, based on what Sarah Huckabee Sanders said this week about what the president did in his involvement in this story, where does it stand today, as you understand it?
Well, I mean, it's just an interesting series of events when the Washington Post has been working on these stories, and I've been on the team recently, in 2 instances in the last 2 weeks, we ask the White House and the president's lawyers about things, and they say publicly that we're wrong. And then when we learn that we're right, we publish the story, the White House confirms that, in fact, that's what happened, that we were right. So it's been an odd reporting experience, but the current state of affairs is that the president did direct his son's statement about how to describe this meeting with a Russian lawyer, and that statement concealed key facts about how this meeting was linked to his own campaign. And people are wondering whether or not there is a reason why he's concealing this information or why he is trying to shape the narrative in such a way that leaves out important facts.
In fact, you're right that, and this was when the president was coming back from the G20, that advisors agreed that Donald Trump Jr. should get ahead of the story, actually be truthful about this meeting. And this was, what, Kushner's lawyers and some other people as well. Why did they want to do it that way?
Well, I think, you know, remember how this all began. Jared Kushner, the son-in-law, is trying to respond to a series of – he's also a senior advisor in the White House, which elevates his importance to Congress and making sure that he's done everything properly that he should have done and that he's not colluding with the Russian government. So in their investigation, they're asking him a lot of questions. He and his lawyer are going through a ton of emails and other documentary evidence about his interactions with various people. The lawyers come across these emails that establish a meeting with a Russian lawyer in the height of the campaign that Jared Kushner had not previously disclosed. So they knew this was going to be embarrassing because it looks like he's hiding a meeting. They also knew it was going to be doubly embarrassing because of the nature of the emails. In them, the meeting, as you know, right, was arranged by Donald Trump Jr., but in them, when offered some suggestion by a family friend that the meeting is one where the Russian lawyer has promised to bring some incriminating information about Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump Jr. responds, "If it's what you say, I love it." And the Jared Kushner team really believed that getting this out into the public in some way on their own terms was going to be a better way of telling this story than having it leak out and them look as though they were concealing something.
But as you write, they were overruled, what, by the president?
So when they were strategizing all of this in the weeks before Donald Trump, the president, and his family members head to the G20 summit. Ivanka is with him. Jared Kushner is with him. Donald Trump Jr. is not. And they are off in Europe, in Hamburg, when they learn from the White House communications team that the New York Times now has a question. So the strategy becomes, deciding on a strategy becomes quite more urgent. Now there's a reporter asking questions. It's a Friday night. What do we do? The lawyers aren't there. The communication strategists, at least the ones for the family members, are not there. And the president sort of takes this bull by the horns and decides how it will go down. And there isn't a lot of interplay with the other legal members of the team, and some of them were shocked and surprised and only learned about it after the New York Times had been issued a statement from Air Force One.
Your story is based in part on a couple of anonymous sources, or certainly people who are not identified, but I'm assuming we're talking about a small group of people who were part of the decision-making. Do you think they're trying to send a message to the president through your story?
We really don't talk about anonymous sources.
No, I understand
So I wouldn't impute any motives. Remember, there's people love to play, and I don't think you're doing that, Marty, but love to play the guessing game in Washington about who's doing what and for what motive. I think a lot of people, a small group of people initially knew how this went down, and then more and more and more people learned about what happened because it was such a legal problem and a public relations disaster. While the president may have thought he was helping by establishing a sort of a beachhead of characterizing this meeting, it ended up being a drip, drip, drip of four more stories, five more stories, and then that spawned thousands of stories about how this was not characterized in a very full and forthcoming way.
Do we know how much the special counsel, this of course would be Robert Mueller, how much he is investigating this particular meeting and then the various descriptions, changing descriptions of what this meeting was about?
I think we're going to learn more even about the nature of this meeting than what's been reported so far. And my understanding from talking to seasoned prosecutors who have been in Bob Mueller's shoes is that it is almost inevitable that Bob Mueller will investigate this meeting and get, as one person said to me who investigated potential crime in the George W. Bush administration, Bob Mueller will need to know who said what, mm-hmm. why they said what they said, and how they came to this statement. Again, prosecutors are interested in why would you lie, and what is it you're trying to hide, and are you trying to throw investigators off the track? Lying to the media, lying to me, is not a crime, but it is a part of a crime if you're covering up something serious.
And Mueller has been hiring a number of lawyers to be part of his team. He hired another lawyer this week, and it looks like he's got a kind of a dream team, I guess, from a prosecution's perspective. Anything you can tell us about who's working with Mueller?
I've been really struck by the expertise that he has brought on board, people who are experts in their field in bribery of foreign officials. That's his most recent ad, a former head of the Foreign Corrupt Practices prosecution team. I've been struck by his emphasis on prosecutors who have experience with Eastern European crime gangs and crime syndicates, his team's expertise in money laundering in foreign countries, the use of particular banks for laundering criminal proceeds and ill-gotten gains stolen by foreign officials from their own country. That gives you not a blueprint for what Mueller is doing, but it gives you a signal of the breadth of this probe. And, you know, remember the kinds of organizations that Michael Flynn had contact with, and Paul Manafort, campaign manager. Michael Flynn was the very short-lived national security advisor to the president and also an advisor to him during the campaign. So both of them have had extensive dealings with foreign officials and are in some legal jeopardy because of those contacts, many of which they did not disclose.
And that's Carol Lenig. She's a Washington Post reporter. And you can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. There have been some attempts, I'm not sure if they're coming directly from inside the White House, but some attempts to undermine Mueller's investigation. What can you tell us?
So the president and his team of allies kind of went really hard at Mueller 2 weekends ago. I've jokingly said that it's hard to know what a weekend is anymore, but and keep everything keep track of time because it happens so fast. But 2 weekends ago, they began tweeting and publicly commenting very critically about a host of people. One, the Attorney General, Jeff Sessions. The president said he was weak and he wouldn't have hired him if he knew that Sessions was going to recuse himself. Remember that Sessions' recusal was a key step that led ultimately to the appointment of the special counsel in May. The president also talked about how conflicted he felt that Bob Mueller and his team were, and many of his close legal allies are now looking at the potential conflicts of Mueller's lawyers and Mueller himself. The president, I'm told, is the most concerned about the political contributions that some of Mueller's team have made to Democratic candidates. Wow. And he's particularly been critical of a deputy FBI director, Andrew McCabe, whose wife was a Democratic candidate. He's also, the president, I'm told, is very upset about Bob Mueller resigning at some point from Trump National Golf Course. I hope I'm saying the name of the golf course, the club, properly. And that in that resignation, the president believes Mueller in some way had a dispute and it created some animus with the Trump organization. Mueller's spokespeople have told us that there was no dispute and this is fanciful. Mm. But again, this is all part of the fabric of at least 2 weekends ago of the president and his lawyers raising serious questions about the ability of Mueller to do his job properly. Keep in mind that one of the grounds for removing a special counsel, and only the attorney general can do this, one of the grounds is a conflict of interest.
There was some discussions about pardons, even a discussion, as I understand it, about whether a president can pardon him or herself. Were these serious discussions, or was it just kind of blue skying all the possibilities?
Well, you know, here at the Post, we broke that story, and I don't have a tape recording of what the president said, but I know from numerous people that he has been asking that question in different forms for many, many weeks, and he has asked both whether he can pardon people close to him, pardon people who had been advisors, pardon his family members, and ultimately whether he can pardon himself. It is not in any way inappropriate for a lawyer, a legal client, to ask these questions. It's probably a good idea to find out what your powers are as president. But many people have found it curious that he would be asking about pardons so soon in the process if he doesn't believe anybody has done anything wrong.
Let me read an email from Philip. He says, so whatever the Russia story is, it seems the cover-up is getting more serious than the event itself. Do we know enough to be able to say that, Carol?
Well, as we were talking about before, Marty, I think that the meeting, the direction of the president about how to characterize that meeting in June 2016 is worrisome because it's part of the fabric of many steps the president has personally taken to discredit, undermine, and try to foil the investigation. So one is very straight up. He fired FBI Director Comey when, according to Comey, he declined to pledge loyalty and declined to agree to end his probe of Michael Flynn, the former National Security Advisor, and to drop this Russia probe. Then you have the president threatening Sessions and the attorney general and questioning the thing that he did that many people consider a very ethical step, to recuse himself because he had a conflict. Remember, Sessions advised the campaign, and so it would be unwise for him to now be overseeing a probe that looks deeply at the campaign. As well, the president personally stepped in, according to what Dan Coats has told Associates, another story the Post broke, in which Coats told his friends and colleagues that the president asked him to intervene with Comey to get him to drop the Russia probe. These are all pieces of a pattern trying to kill this investigation, and I guess a gentle word for it is to end it. The president may genuinely believe he's done nothing wrong and this is a political witch hunt. That is certainly what he has told close advisors that I've spoken with. But if there's anything underneath this probe, if there's any crime that's happened, it makes it look like the president is trying to hide that.
We have to end on that note. Washington Post reporter Carol Lenig, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Of course.
And she was part of this reporting team breaking several stories, including the story of President Trump dictating his son's response to his controversial meeting with a Russian lawyer back in June of 2016. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. This note, Cindy Clemens, our first guest, will be speaking at Big Blue Marble Bookstore in the Mount Airy neighborhood of Philadelphia at 7 o'clock tonight. I'm Marty Moskowain. Thank you for joining us.